So even a new baby artist that's just starting out, I would recommend they get an LLC. You know, you are going to limit your personal liability protection. You are going to get some tax benefits, and you should have a business around your music business. And then I also think that we start developing, what are these different areas of your music monetization? Are you signed up with a PRO? Do you know what the MLC and Sound Exchange are? Do all your songs that you've written, do you have split sheets? Do you have producer agreements with your producers? Is everything papered before you put music out? Before we even talk about anybody coming to the table with a potential deal, is everything pretty clean, cleaned up and tidy?
What's up? I'm Brandman Sean.
And I'm Corey.
And we are back with another episode of No Labels Necessary Podcast. You can stream us anywhere that you stream your podcast, YouTube, Spotify, etc. Here at the intersection of creativity and currency. And you know, when we do this intro, we have a very special guest today. We have Ryan Schmidt of Bowen Schmidt Entertainment Attorneys. We got to talk about the legal stuff because that is a huge deal. And a lot of artists have been caught slipping lately. But we're not going to get into that just yet. First, I just want to start off, Ryan, appreciate you being on. Glad to have you, man.
Thank you so much for having us. For having me, I'm really excited to be here.
Man, it's always good to have, you know, a lawyer on. Right, we plan to have more of you guys on. If you like this, you know, this whole flow, hopefully, you know, you come back. Because there are a lot of topics we just don't touch on because, you know, that's not our business. but there's a lot of real information that can help artists out there. Today, we got to start out with one of the topics that we were talking about right before the pod. Like, artists don't know whether or not they own their masters, right? There's this thought. Legitimate, well-to-do, successful executives have said that whoever pays for your masters owns your masters. So if I go in the studio, I lay down a track, and then I take off and I say, hey, Ja'Cory, can you pay for this? Because I have some other things to do. And Ja'Cory uses his own credit card, pays for the masters. Apparently he owns the song. That's what I've been hearing. Is that correct?
No, that's not true. So it all goes back to copyright, right? Money alone isn't going to equal ownership. The Copyright Act says that whoever is the author, whoever creates an independent, protectable piece of work, whether that's lyrics, music, sound recording, they are the author and owner of that copyright, whether it's the master recording, whether it's the publishing and the music and lyrics. So this idea of money equals ownership of the master really comes down to a contract. You know, a company like a record label can't own from the gate a master because they aren't a creative. They aren't an artist. They can't record, right? They're just a company that holds a whole bunch of property.
Yeah.
But what they can do is they can enter a contract, which is a recording contract, if we're talking about a label, that can say, in exchange for money, in exchange for this advance, in exchange for me paying for this recording, you, the artist, are entering this contract that says, I, the label, am either going to own these masters or you're going to license the masters to me and I'm going to have the right to release it. So it's always money plus the contract. Because think about it this way, if it's just the money, there could be a lot of weird situations that end up that wouldn't be anybody's intent. You know, you've got a rich grandfather that gives you some money to go in the studio and record. You've got Kickstarter, you know, the crowdfunded thing. You've got a bank gives you a loan. Where would it end at that point? So just because somebody has paid for the studio time or somebody, you know, is giving you the equipment to use, that doesn't alone equal copyright ownership and ownership of the master.
I'm glad you said that because, you know, the more recent conversation is who paid for it. But I've also heard the other, like whoever owns the studio as well, like owns the master or whatever. So where does that come from? Like, what do you think the confusion is if that's just outright untrue? Because, again, there's some experienced people who believe this to be true.
I think that it comes from industry standards, and there's industry standards, of course, and then there's what the law says. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with certain ways of doing things and the way that the industry does things, but it just has to be you know, two consenting adults say, yes, I agree to that. You know, if somebody says to me, Ryan, look, this is my studio. I paid for this recording. I brought everybody in on this. You know, I want to own this master. Do you agree to that? And I say, yes, that's absolutely fine. But there just isn't a default rule of, you know, I'm funding this, so I'm going to own this.
I'm glad you said industry standard, man, because that's a common term we like to throw around mm-hmm. in the industry, right? It's, oh, this is a standard contract, but you just said standard doesn't necessarily mean law, right? Which also implies a lot of flexibility. And more artists are starting to realize, well, yes, that could be the standard per se, if that's even true, because you're just telling me this is standard. But I don't have to go with said standard because I might be worth more, or there might be aspects of this agreement that don't work for me. How do you view this term, like standard, as a lawyer, right? I'm sure you've acknowledged, hey, this is a standard contract in one thing or another.
Well, for me, you know, the standard is the norm. And I think that that's baseline, right?
Yeah.
And the industry standard has kind of sucked for artists, right? And so standard isn't necessarily good. It's just the way that it's always been done. Mm-hmm. And as a lawyer, as also an artist advocate, I try to keep pushing that standard to a more artist-friendly place. But yeah, there are certain rules and percentages that you want to see in a deal. You know, if it's a management agreement and you know that a manager typically is going to take between 10 and 20% of what an artist brings home, you see a management deal that says 50-50, that's way outside of the standard. And you know, we've got certain percentages like that that exist throughout the entire music industry. So there are rules and there are standards. And when they go so far outside of that, that's where I usually have a big issue.
Got you. Yeah, like even outside of music, I personally have had certain contracts where people will come to me and will say, hey, this is what standard looks like if I want to be involved. And to me, I look at it as, this is just information. I appreciate that information. You've now told me what is typical, but that has nothing to do with whether or not that works for me, mm-hmm. right? But in some occasions, it might be better than what I thought. So I was like, okay, cool. This is what standard is. I love it. But in some occasions, it's like, well, that doesn't work for me. So, you know, we're going to have to figure something out. But it is good to know where the baseline is. And I think acknowledging that flexibility, like you said, like standard isn't necessarily good. It's just a baseline. It's something that I would love more artists to take to heart, because I've seen so many types of agreements at this point, right? You could pretty much play with everything. Like because I follow a lot of entrepreneurs, I've always, it's been a while since I've learned about like just creative deal making, right? Because I came up in sales for a period of time, and it's like, well, whatever makes it work. My standard deal, hey, if you want to sign up for this program, I don't know, $50 a month, okay? But this guy, he has a brand that I like. Maybe I say only $20. Or maybe I say, hey, you get it for free, right? But then we barter in some other form of fashion and we get an outcome that we both desire. I think artists should always kind of consider, what are all your assets, right? And if they know what all their assets are, then they'll probably understand better how to leverage those different assets. So if you could kind of speak to different types of deals or different levers that artists could pull outside of what might be perceived to be standard when doing a, let's say, label distribution and maybe even a management deal, I think that'll be pretty helpful for artists to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And just know, like, for the label type of deal, the type of deal that's being offered, that first draft that the label gives you, rarely is that a take it or leave it. You just got to accept it. You know, everything is open to negotiation, even what that deal covers. You know, you could have a label deal that covers, it's a 360 deal that covers the recorded music, your publishing, and gets a piece of anything else you do in the entertainment industry, whether it's acting, whether it's, you know, writing a book, whether it's being on a podcast. So there's that type of deal. Then there's other label deals where it might just be the recorded music. You are their recording artist and they're going to give you a percentage of it. And that's kind of more what I like to see more these days, because the 360 deal really came up about 15 years ago with Napster and downloading rising, and people stopped going to Walmart buying CDs. And they said, shit, we need to get as much money as we can in other sources. But if I'm representing an artist and there's a 360 deal and they want to get a piece of, you know, this artist's potential future acting career, I always ask, what relationships do you have in the world of acting that can justify that percentage? You know, if you're just taking a piece for the sake of taking a piece, but you can't actually generate opportunities, I'm not interested in giving you that piece. So that's kind of what I look for in the label side of things. I mean, the management, you can do any number of things. And there's a lot of good examples of artist manager relationships that still work on a handshake. I don't recommend it because, you know, you just don't know what the terms are. What happens if in 5 years from now, you thought everything was going good and the manager said, I'm going to take 10%. And then a dispute happens and the manager now says, I was going to take 25, you know, and now they have to prove who's actually entitled to what. That can get super messy. So I always like written management contracts. But as far as what you can do with that, you can always write into those deals what is and is not included. If this is a music manager, again, somebody who only has resources and connections in the music industry, but you were also, you know, a Twitch streamer, or you are an actor, or you're doing something else in the entertainment vertical, maybe that percent is 10% there and you get a manager that just does acting, that just does film. And you can actually have multiple managers in different verticals. So that's what I like to do in that area.
No, I love that. I love that. Because I think, especially with the management side of things, a lot of people just assume, well, you're my manager and you're there for everything. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think in some cases, that's even unfair on a manager side, because that doesn't allow them to focus. And then you also are judging them up against the progress in an area that they might not even be on for in their head. So to me, which is, I guess, no surprise, like, everything you're saying is about clarity, right? Let's clearly agree upon these things and have it written down. I do know quite a few people who are on the handshake deals, and so far they're all going good, the ones I know.
Yeah, the ones I know, yeah. They're strong so far.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess there is all that risk. But the big point that you're making, though, like, again, like, all right, if I'm acting, then I have that kind of manager. Music. Are there any other type of managers an artist might have?
Well, a business manager is definitely one that, if you're signed to a big management company, they're going to require you to have a business manager, somebody that actually collects your money and then cuts the checks to all the people, including your manager, that is running your books and making sure that everything is done correctly. And a business manager is somebody who's essentially a bookkeeper, accountant, you know, does your payroll, keeps that all tidy. And a lot of them usually do it on a 5% commission of everything that comes in. So a business manager, you know, your personal manager, your artist manager. And then, of course, you know, if you're a touring artist, you might have a tour manager, but that's more specific to, you know, your live performances.
Business managers take 5% of everything that's coming in. And as everything that you just said was, it sounded very accounting-like, right? Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. Business managers, you should think of them as accountants. They are the ones that are collecting all the money. They might be settling up with, reconciling different royalty statements from labels, settling up with venues, making sure that everybody's getting their piece, whether it's the personal manager, whether it's a producer that you have to pay from an artist producer agreement, you know, whoever the artist owes some money to, it could be a lawyer as well, whoever the artist owes money to, that business manager is going to make sure that that's taken care of. And also there's some like personal money management and advisement that goes in there. You know, hey, you just got this $100,000 advance. This is supposed to cover both your budget of your next record and for you to live for the next 2 years. Maybe don't go out there and buy, you know, a brand new car. You know, you think about this a little bit differently.
I have my main manager. I'm giving him 10 to 20%, right? I can get with that. That makes a lot of sense. If they're supposed to be eating and bringing me opportunities and building infrastructure with me consistently, really it's a co-owner of my business per se, not exactly, but in a sense. But then there's so many other places that artists are giving percentages. And when I hear just percent, to me, it just sounds like a bad habit the music industry has versus a need in a lot of cases. Like in any other business, if I'm thinking about how I split up and how I pay for things, if you're on the sales team, right, you're bringing in money and that's your job to bring in money, you're getting commission. But if you're doing more admin work, I'm paying you something fixed, right? So if I'm hearing a more accounting role, why am I paying a business manager, right, to do paperwork on a percentage base versus just a regular flat fee? Like, have you seen people doing something opposite, or do you feel that makes sense? Like, tell me, am I tripping?
No, I think you're right. And I think every business manager, just like every lawyer, probably does things a little bit differently. The business managers I've seen do that percentage. And that's really because they are working with artists that are with these major management outfits. And that's a requirement of that management deal to make sure that the manager is getting paid. That doesn't mean that there isn't someone that's out there doing hourly or flat fee or anything like that.
Can you explain what you mean when you say that's a requirement of that deal to make sure the management gets paid? Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. So say you've got a major management company that's signing an artist to manage, and they're taking 15 to 20% of what the artist brings in. They want to make sure that in exchange for them getting these opportunities, them working, et cetera, that they're getting paid what they're owed. And if it's a smaller artist and there's not that many revenue sources, that might be easy enough for the personal manager to manage themselves without a business manager. But if it's a bigger artist with multiple revenue streams and it's almost a full-time job to keep track of everything that's coming in, touring, publishing, merchandising, you know, everything that comes in, then a business manager makes a lot of sense for both the personal manager and for the artist. But that's, you know, a little bit outside of what I do as a lawyer, but I do work really closely with a lot of business managers. So I know they do that.
Gotcha. Are those business managers typically it sounds like they're a part of the management firm, like it's the same firm, but that's just like, we have business managers, we have day-to-day managers, is that what it is, like one management company, you're saying?
There are situations where that exists, but I'm usually talking about outside companies that just do the business management piece of it.
Got you. Okay.
But something you said was really interesting, fascinating, about the music industry's obsessed with taking percentages. And it's certainly true in the legal industry too, in the music business. You know, it's very common for lawyers to take a percentage of a deal that's being negotiated if the label or the publishing company, whoever is working on that deal, isn't willing to fund the artist's legal bill. Then the lawyer will charge a percentage almost as an accommodation to this artist who doesn't have money to pay a lawyer out of pocket. But there, I think there's a little bit more, I feel like there's a little bit more investment because the lawyer is actively in there negotiating that deal to be the biggest and best it possibly can be.
Artists, managers, there is no way you should ever do a regular pre-save campaign again, because Forever Fan has Forever Saves, where a fan could pre-save your music one time and then automatically pre-save every song you ever release after that. That's right, forever. And on top of that, Forever Fan has email and texting all in one platform. This is built out for artists who don't have huge teams and don't want to get overwhelmed doing too many things in too many different places. So go to foreverfanmusic.com/no labels. That's no labels with an S, and put in the code NOLABELS02 to get access and try it out for only $1. ForeverFan is your go-to place for your marketing needs as an artist, so you can stay organized, have your own infrastructure to make it a lot easier to go to the next level. Again, that's foreverfanmusic.com/no labels and type in the code NOLABELS02 at checkout to get access for only $1. Now back to the episode.
You know, I'm glad you said that, man. One thing I remember hearing really early when I started working in music is somebody told me that the quickest way to get to a label is through a lawyer. you know, like, and I've even had people tell me that, like, hey, in a lot of instances, and you go into these buildings, like, lawyers will sometimes be even more powerful than the people in the building that maybe even brought your name up or brought you into it. So, just curious to hear your thoughts on that, man. I don't know if you're on that side, like if you've ever, you know, kind of done like one of those deals, but just curious to see, one, you know, why is it that you think that's the thinking? Like why are people kind of looking at lawyers as the top dogs in a situation where you would expect, like, you know, the head of A&R or like the VP of A&R or something to be controlling or control the situation? And then two, is that a route that a lot of lawyers take? Like, are there a lot of lawyers who are like, you know, I'm sure in it to do good legal work, but are they really just A&Rs with a law degree? You know what I'm saying? Am I making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me start with that first piece of it. As far as the lawyer being the one to, why is the lawyer playing this role here, and why are they getting involved in potentially it's like an A&R piece? The lawyer's footprint in an artist that they're representing, the time could be pretty short, but it can be really impactful. And so that lawyer can work with dozens, hundreds of artists and see every single type of deal on a pretty regular basis, from a label deal to a touring deal to a merchandising deal. They get a lot more visibility on all the different types of things that are out there, more so than what an artist, one single artist or manager might see in their career. So the lawyer does get to play in a lot of different sandboxes, so to speak, in the music industry. But you bring up a good point about the lawyer's role in like a record deal or introducing. It's certainly something that happens. You know, I now negotiating a deal with Sony or Universal or whatever, I've now struck up a friendship with somebody who's an A&R, somebody who's in the legal department. You know, I know those people. And I can pass off a client if it's the right fit. But you've hit on something that's the major label's biggest lie that they tell artists. If you just cold called Sony and you said, I'm an artist, I want to set up a meeting, I want a record deal, the first thing they'll say to you is, we don't take unsolicited calls, but call us back with an entertainment lawyer and we'll be happy to take your submission. That doesn't mean that they want you to call back with a lawyer and they're going to give you a deal. That means that they don't think you're going to go through that hoop of hiring a lawyer. So they're just going to kick you to the curb. So that is a common myth too. Not to say that lawyers don't play that role and haven't ever got a client a meeting or a deal, but it's also a double-edged sword, where the label is just thinking most people are too lazy to probably call a lawyer and to try to reach out that way.
So y'all are like the barrier because they know the price is gonna deter probably at least 90% of people. You know what I'm saying? That's smart.
It does make sense, yeah, right? It does make sense. Because it's qualifying. It's like, well, if they actually do come with a lawyer, there's some level of seriousness. There might be more together. Lawyers probably aren't gonna call a label with some BS. They would advise, no, I'm not going to call and put my name on it, right? So I think that's probably pretty smart on their part. Because I do find like lawyers to be at the intersection of two things that are primary in the music industry. That's paperwork and people, right? Over and over again, it always leads back to that. Like, you get a lot of things without money done if you know the right people, right? Or open a lot of doors, and then obviously the paperwork is going to be the thing that shoots you in the foot, depending on how it goes, right? So, like, for you as a lawyer in this industry, have you seen, do you feel like artists understand the value of a lawyer enough beyond, hey, when it's time to sign a contract, you technically probably should have one to make sure you're not getting screwed over? But do you think most artists understand the value that lawyers have beyond just that technical aspect of things?
I don't think that most artists understand the value of having a lawyer beyond just the deal. A lot of artists think that the best time to call a lawyer is when they've already been in a bad deal and things are going sideways and they need to call a lawyer to get out of that bad deal. You know, the easiest way to get out of a bad deal is to get in a time machine and never sign it in the first place, because you can only get out if there is a legal basis to get out. If there was some requirement that the label was supposed to do that they're not meeting and the label gives you that out, yeah, absolutely, let's get out of it. But for the most part, it's just artists that sign these terrible deals thought, I can save a few bucks not having a lawyer look at it. I think I know everything that it says in here anyway. I'll go ahead and sign it. That's where you get into a lot of trouble.
Yes, I mean, I guess, you know, assuming you're an artist, career is moving, you know, you get to a point to where maybe you're doing a couple of deals a year. Like you said, that's when they usually are reaching out. So, I mean, what's the cadence that you're kind of recommending to your clients? Like, how often do you have your clients check in and just talk to you? I'm assuming maybe about, like, career updates or things like that outside of the deals. Like, what does that look like?
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of benefit to talking to a lawyer really early on in your career, as long as you don't confuse their role with a manager or an agent. You know, most lawyers aren't out there to get you deals. They're here to do legal work and to advise you. So even a new baby artist that's just starting out, I would recommend they get an LLC. You know, you are going to limit your personal liability protection. You are going to get some tax benefits, and you should have, like, you know, you should have a business around your music business. And then I also think that we start developing, what are these different areas of your music monetization? Are you signed up with a PRO? Do you know what the MLC and Sound Exchange are? Do all your songs that you've written, do you have split sheets? Do you have producer agreements with your producers? Is everything kind of papered before you put music out? Before we even talk about anybody coming to the table with a potential deal, is everything pretty cleaned up and tidy? You know, have you registered for your federal copyright? I can't, or your trademark. I can't tell you how many people have said, you know, somebody just released a new album, they stole my name, and that's my name. I need them to take it down. I said, do you have a trademark? You know, is that actually your name? Have you federally registered it? Because if you haven't, those rights are a lot weaker. So there's a lot that can be done before we're talking about deals. But then, to your point about what kind of cadence, anytime an artist is potentially signing a deal that has some long-term consequences, that's when you need to have a lawyer take a look at it. If you're having you're going to play a local show and it's going to be a couple hundred bucks and you're going to play it for one night, maybe not something you need a lawyer to look at. But if somebody's trying to get a piece of your entire music catalog and they want to control it for the next 15 years, absolutely have a lawyer take a look at that.
That makes me think, the naming part in particular. Like, I've had a few people that I've worked with or just known that will have the same name as somebody that's in another country. And, you know, the other artists will randomly catch a hit, and that's when they first find out about them, and now they're wondering what they should do. They're either going through a name change and have to go through that headache on DSPs, and some of them are trying to stick it out. Is there a worldwide name trademark that protects you, one, like, from a legal side, and then two, do you have any suggestion in that type of case, like, hey man, you're not that big yet, so it'll be easier to do it now and later? Like, what are your thoughts on that type of scenario?
So whether we're talking about copyright, whether we're talking about trademark, and for an artist in the United States, those protections through registration are really only going to protect you in the borders of the United States. But that doesn't mean that they aren't going to be respected by other countries, because we have treaties with all these other countries that have very similar intellectual property rights. You know, the UK might say, in exchange for you recognizing the US, in exchange for you recognizing the validity of one of our artist copyrights, you know, we're going to allow XYZ to happen if it happens in your borders, but it's stealing one of our artist songs. The thing that's kind of cruel and difficult for artists to reconcile is that you, as the owner of your name, of your songs, of your recordings, you are responsible for policing your own music and your own copyrights, your own trademarks. And what I mean by that is you are deemed to have known what exists out there. And if you don't protect yourself from somebody else using it within a certain amount of time, you might lose those rights, or you may weaken the rights that you have. So you constantly have to be out there monitoring what's out there in the world and taking action when necessary.
That's crazy.
So I want to get into a couple other scenarios that I've heard you talk about. One being the Bad Bunny situation, which I didn't know about until learning about it from you, where a fan recorded Bad Bunny at his concert and Bad Bunny sued him. Initially, my thoughts was like, yo, that's kind of bad for fan culture, but you kind of won me out, and I felt like the fan probably deserved it. Can you speak more on that case?
Absolutely. So there was a fan that recorded a Bad Bunny concert, and he recorded about a third of the entire concert, and he posted it on YouTube. So we're not talking about, you know, a 30-second clip that he put on TikTok or Instagram. He put a good chunk of this 10 whole songs on a monetized YouTube account, which is pretty tough. And then Bad Bunny's team just tried to do a copyright strike, said, hey, this violates our copyrights. All we ask is that you take it down, because we are the owners of this. It's harmful to the brand. It's harmful to being able to monetize this, because some fans, I mean, it looks like a camera shot concert, but there certainly are some people out there that would say, why do I need to see the Bad Bunny show now that I've seen it on YouTube? You know, or they might say, I kind of wanted to go see it, but once I saw that YouTube video, it didn't look that good. So why would I pay X amount of dollars for a ticket when it comes through my city? So Bad Bunny's team reached out to them through a YouTube copyright strike and just took it offline and said, we own this. Just stop doing it. And that should have been the end of it. And that's where, most of these times where a major label or an artist sues a fan or somebody that's infringing, they always give the other side the opportunity to stop doing something. Just walk away. We're not going to ask for any money. Just stop. And when people don't stop, then they give them no other choice. So the way that the takedown system works under the U.S. Copyright Act is the DSPs and the social media have what is known as a safe harbor. They can't be personally liable for somebody on YouTube posting something that infringes somebody else's copyright if, once they hear about that, they immediately take action and take that down. But you've got this 14-day period. So they got to take it down, and they've done that. But you've got this 14-day period where they investigate, and the person who had originally posted it that gets taken down gets to make a counterclaim or a defense and says, well, I actually think this is mine for XYZ reasons. This poster said, I think it's mine because of fair use, which fair use is its own thing, but it definitely didn't apply here because he was trying to monetize it and it wasn't any of his own music. So if you want to keep something down beyond that 14 days under the takedown procedures, you have no choice but to file a lawsuit to show the YouTube, we've got this court case, here's the case caption, here's the number, here's everything to keep this down. So it's not so much a money grab, because it's very possible that this fan doesn't have the $1.5 million that they're seeking. And that is also statutory. It's not like they just picked that number out of a hat. It's $150,000 per willful infringement, and he did it for 10 songs. So it's $1.5 million. But I don't really think that they're trying to collect or go the full distance on that. They just had no other choice but to do that to keep that music offline.
It's interesting you said it, right? Like, I don't think they want to take it that far. It feels like the industry taking a stance against fan entitlement, right? Because when I was watching the whole case, you know, and I've seen the sentiment online where fans are like, hey, like, I've already spent so much money on you, I deserve this, or hey, you made it for us, you know what I'm saying? So it's technically me. And I think that just because of where socials are and where content is, it's probably one of the first times we've seen artists be very vocal about, like, nah, fuck y'all. Like, you know what I'm saying? This is for me. This is on my terms and my thing. So this case almost felt like Bad Bunny and his team sending a message to his fans and saying, like, hey, this is my ship. I run this how I want to run it. And when I'm ready for the world to see it, you know, everything could be all peachy keen and hunky-dory. And if y'all step out of line, this is what that looks like. You know what I'm saying?
100% agree.
It sends a great message, too. Yeah, for sure. For sure. A lot of fans definitely won't be trying that.
Yeah,
I wonder if it was just like a kid, you know, or, you know, person who just posted. They're probably not used to it. Like, if it wasn't like even a big YouTube page like that, do you know if it was a bigger page or a smaller page?
I don't know. But I do know that the quality was actually pretty good, you know, from like the equipment that he used, the microphones that he used. It wasn't just iPhone, it was like potentially a DSLR with like a, you know, an external microphone.
And yeah, so yeah, he's doing official bootleg, and that's a little different. That's a little different. I understand that then. I mean, speaking of those types of cases, then, because you just said something interesting, right? They will give you a chance to take it down, right? To make a change. And we've been hearing a lot about the Trey Fuego case and how that's been turning out. They owe Sony $800,000, right? Based on how things got decided in court. Can you speak more about that situation in general? Like, do you know that someone did Sony reach out and try to say, hey, let's make a deal on the song or pay us something particular and everything will be good? And he just didn't take the deal. Like, how did it get to this point?
Part of the problem is that, and looking into this case, it's still kind of hard to determine who Trey Fuego is. It's not like there's a lot of information of him online. What did you say?
It's hard to determine who he is, period.
Right. Yeah. Like, if you Google who he is, like, you can't even find his legal name. So that was one of the big problems about this case. They were trying to even get in touch with him, and they couldn't. He kept ignoring him, and you know, it was one of those things that they tried to reach out and tried to come up with some type of deal. Anytime you have a uncleared sample and the song does really well, the last thing that a label is going to want to do, unless there's some other reason to object to that use, like, you know, the Kanye and the Donna Summer and the Ozzy Osbourne stuff. That aside, but if you have like a Trey Fuego and the song is doing well and it's making money, labels are typically pretty smart, and they're going to say, I think there's probably a chance to partner here and to make some money off of this, and we'll come in 50-50, and we'll also ask for some percentage of the amount that's already been collected on the song. And that's usually how that kind of gets all cleared up on the back end, unless they just want it taken down for some reason. But here, let's assume that they tried that, it didn't go anywhere. They were in a position where they were forced to sue because, again, they didn't hear back, he didn't reach a deal, and then they took it down. They did the DMCA takedown, and then they had to file a lawsuit to keep it offline. And they had this judge, and this was in the Federal District Court of Texas. And this judge was pretty hardcore. He was not a fan of the fact that this artist very intentionally stole this song and didn't try to work out any type of deal and didn't even participate in this case. You know, most people, you know, when they get sued, they try to fight it. You know, they tried to put on some type of defense, and he didn't put any type of effort in there. And the judge, I mean, he was evading service. They would try to find him, and like sheriffs and private process service, you try to serve him, and he would just, you know, keep evading that service. And so finally the judge in that case said, we'll allow you to serve this defendant through an Instagram direct message, which is just wild, because if I'm filing a lawsuit, I have to give it to a sheriff, a marshal, or some private process server that's appointed by the court to physically deliver process to the defendant and get that, like an affidavit that actually happened. So for a judge to say this direct message is good enough, it's pretty wild. But anyway, they say that that's good enough, and he's served, and he doesn't participate at all. There's all these motions that are filed. He doesn't participate in it. They keep asking for that money because it isn't just some number that they pulled out of a hat. It is the estimation of what that song generated. So they're asking, because you stole that song, we're asking for you to turn over those profits because you got that from theft, essentially. And I think, you know, whether or not that's going to go anywhere. Oh, was that?
Would that be 100%? They project that that's 100% of the money. Like, we want all the money back at this point since you haven't participated, or is that still like a percentage?
That'd be 100%. But if I was that guy, I'd say, look, I'll just file bankruptcy right now and the whole thing goes away.
I mean, he's already this deep in this direction. You know, I mean, it seems so ill-advised, where it could have came out like better and clearer, and he could have built a little bit more of a career off of it and still been going and still had the money from the songs. Like you said, the labels weren't probably going to take away all of the money, probably a really big portion. Like you said, 50%, I wouldn't be surprised if more, but I don't know. This is such an odd case, man. Did you see that the song was taken down from his page, but then it was re-uploaded again from some other mystery account? Did you see that?
Yeah, I did see that.
What do you think is happening there?
I think, and I've seen this from time to time, I think that they're basically copycats, that people will find these songs and they don't have any ownership of it or any claim to it, and they'll get taken down, and they know that it's popular, and they'll re-upload it and try to make some money off of it. The same thing happened with the Drake, The Weeknd, Hard on Our Sleeves AI song that gets taken off, and then multiple people start reposting it in all these different places, even though they weren't the person who created it.
So you think it's more like opportunist troll or something, not Trey necessarily uploading it again on the side or something?
Yeah, I think it's troll.
This is, I don't know, man. It's just so weird. It's so weird to duck court and all those things, unless he has some other stuff going on where he feels like, I don't want to see the police at all, you know, or something.
That's about for 4 years, bro. That's
yeah, crazy. For 4 years, just to not be served about this. I don't know. It seems so ill-advised and a bigger opportunity missed. But maybe that money, seeing that money come in, just like the mentality might just be like, oh yeah, I'm not sharing anything. I hit a lick or something. I don't know, man. That's so crazy. That's so crazy. I can't really be on the artist side on that one. The label kind of has
that. Yeah, no, he definitely fucked up. Very hard. Like, I don't understand how the fans are taking his side. Fans don't know, but it's very hard to know even a little bit and just be on his side, bro. And if you see this, all right, bro, you know, it is what it is. But that makes me think, man, because what he did and how he handled that moment, I guess, let's say pre-Sony reaching out, right, is something that I've seen be advised to people before, right, where like, hey, if you're in a situation where, you know, maybe there's an unclear sample, there's an instrumental or something like that, and you don't technically have the rights to it, hey, man, just do your thing and
I've even had somebody say to me, like, hey, but if you get hit with a lawsuit, that means you're doing things right. That means you got big enough to where they actually care enough about you in that regard. I can imagine it has to be stressful as a lawyer looking at the space to, like, the internet content space of that and some of the advice getting pushed out and seeing that artists are willfully engaging in something that could put them in a very similar situation. Because I think Trey Fuego is the best and worst case example of that. Right? Like, hey, you had this song that did take the fuck off and you don't have to go through all these loopholes to get it there. But look at what you're going through down the line. Because, you know, we was even doing the math later. I had a friend that guesstimated that Sony probably asked him for like 70%. And so me and Sean did the math. I was like, damn, bro. So, you know, he would have to give up like 600K. You still would have kept 200. You know what I'm saying? Assuming things went the way it went. Now you got to give all of it back, right? And I can imagine there's at least 50 more hymns out there that are probably getting ready to pop in and be in a very, very similar situation. But they probably heard people say, like, hey, just fuck it. Just do what you got to do until the song hits.
That you're hitting the nail on the head with another thing where the industry standards do not follow the law. So I, as a lawyer, am always like, always get clearances, samples cleared, and loops cleared ahead of time. And think about it this way, you know, if he reached out to Sony, and they have licensing clearance departments, of course they do, every label does. If he reached out to them as this independent artist who had zero monthly listeners, and he said, I've got this song, and they liked the song, and he said, what would it be to clear this? They probably would have quoted him something like $2,500, $5,000, something pretty minimal, and he would have been good to go. But when you wait for something, if you say, I'll get around to clearing it, even though that's how the industry typically does it, if you wait around till it hits, now you've given them all the data. They've got all the ammunition they need because they know exactly how much money is being made. So they don't just want their standard licensing fee for this unknown artist and the song that may or may not do anything. They want a big chunk of this hit, and you're pretty much like at the mercy of doing what they say they're going to do, or like Trey Fuego facing a copyright infringement lawsuit. And the saddest thing about that case for me is that song was a huge hit. There's over 170 million streams. That is technically a platinum record if we're talking about streams these days, because 75 million streams is a gold record if it's certified. So you had a platinum record as this indie artist, and there's probably a path for Sony to come in to take some things. You now get a certified platinum record, and you are now fielding new offers, new opportunities. Maybe there was even a deal with Sony to be had. Yeah. But you botched it.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely enough movement. We know how this industry works. Plenty of people will hop out the woodworks, managers, labels, to be able to try to like nurture that situation and make it bigger than what it already was. So definitely a botch on that part. Like I said, I wonder if there's, I don't know, something that we're completely missing. But I'm not going to lie. If I go to Young Indie Sean brain, if I'm an artist, all right, and I hear everything that you just said, the way I hear the situation is, oh yeah, I'm still gonna put out a track anyway without getting it cleared because I don't have the upfront money. If I'm gonna create 100 songs, I only really wanna have to pay for the one that pops. And if they do wanna come charge me for these ones that didn't pop, which they probably wouldn't, I mean, it wouldn't be much money to split anyway, but the one that pops, okay, I'm just not going to be like this Trey guy, and I'm going to say, yes, I'm going to answer the phone, and I'll let them get a percentage, and then I'll flip my brand off of that. That's what, like, a young indie artist Sean would do if I was, like, you know, 19 years old or something. So I would love to hear your retort to that.
Okay, so there's two problems with the young Sean approach, okay? One is it used to be a lot easier to get away with copyright infringement, both from a cultural perspective and from a just technological perspective. Before the Blurred Lines case, you know, for the last 50 years, people were pretty cool with sampling in hip hop and really just reusing and being inspired by things. And then that case really changed things, where we're a lot more sensitive to copyright and we're a lot more litigious. So everything changed 10, 11 years ago as far as what is and isn't acceptable, for better or for worse. But then the other thing is, you used to be able to get away with it. You know, there were so many songs out there that you had to have found that song for you to even know that somebody had stolen it or used it. With AI, that all changes. There's this tool called CoverNet where you upload your entire discography and it scans the whole song, and it even creates stems, AI stems. Like, they'll know if it's your voice, if it's your drum beat, if it's your, you know, violin, if it's your guitar. They'll know all these different things. And if any of that, including just a clone of your voice, is used anywhere on any of the DSPs, social media, et cetera, without your credit, your compensation, without your, you know, permission, you're going to be able to take that down and find it pretty immediately. So you no longer really have that opportunity to kind of just like skate by and say, well, if nobody knows about it and it doesn't blow up, it's not going to be an issue.
They will know.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, I guess it's good overall. You know what I'm saying? A net good, but crazy.
yeah. Sheesh. They got to find a new way in this era to figure out their way up. Well, I guess that's creating original music.
I feel like it's easier said than done. You know? At this stage, you know what I'm saying? Because even even the Trey situation, man, like, what's so sad about it to me, because I was telling Sean, I got hip to the case maybe like 3 days ago. And the song was still on his account. He was at maybe like 2.83 million monthly listeners. We checked it right before this episode. The song is down. He's dropped down to like 80,000 monthly listeners. So we're talking about, like, I don't even know the math, like crazy thousands of percent decrease. And I can imagine that song is probably 95% of his catalog. But then even the trickle over to the rest of his music, you know what I'm saying, it was probably crazy. So it's like, I don't know. I think it's a great example of how, because I don't think enough indie artists progress further enough along in their career to see the results of their bad decisions, and which I think is a part of the issue, right? You have 20,000 artists telling you that this thing is okay, but they've never progressed to the position to where that thing is no longer okay. So in their head, they're right? Like, you'll be okay, like, this isn't going to happen. But then it's like, it takes that one that breaks through to the other side for everybody to see, like, oh no, they really take this seriously. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is, and it makes sense to me, because if you think about what's so interesting about music, is that it's probably the only industry where majority of the people that want to get in it don't understand the industry. I've never really seen that in any other industry. You know what I'm saying? And it makes sense. You know, a kid wakes up every day and wants to be a music artist, but that doesn't mean that he's suddenly, you know, basking in this great thirst for knowledge, you know, about the industry and things like that. But I do think, as sad as it is, it is a warning to artists of, like, hey, like, don't think that, you know, Lil Sean's decision today, you know, if you go as far as you think you're going to go, then you're really shooting yourself in the foot. You know what I'm saying? It's crazy.
And what artist doesn't think they're going to blow up, right? I mean, that's kind of the delusion that you need to have to be a successful artist. Because if some artist, like, was told, if they were visited by their future self and they're like, man, you're going to get kicked down every single day, it sucks, you're underpaid, you're underappreciated, you know, whatever, they might not want to do it. But, you know, most artists that I see that become successful have that fuck you mentality. I'm going to do what I need to do because I know I'm different. There's 120,000 songs uploaded to the DSPs each day, and my song is going to be the one that pops. You know, and that's what it really takes. So, you know, if you are planning for that, you know, don't think so small. Don't think mine won't be the problem. You know, always plan for doing it the right way, so you're covered when you do blow up.
Man, so that makes me think of something, man. So, you know, you talked about the Robin Thicke case changed things with that. You know, me and Sean talked about it. I feel like we're in the era of legal change in music. There's like a new lawsuit or case, you know what I'm saying, popping up, it feels like, every couple of months. It's kind of a chicken or the egg question. Who do you feel like is responsible for change in the industry? Is it the job of the artist to become aware and speak out? Or is it the job of the business people to push that forward and make everyone aware? How do you feel being on your side of things?
I mean, it really is both. You need to have enough people on both sides of the industry, the artist side and the business side of it, that really care about changing the way things are done, because that's just the way it's been done is no longer good enough. You know, the idea of the companies owning masters forever and just paying artists a 15% royalty after millions of dollars are recouped, that doesn't make sense anymore. And you've got deals that are looking a lot better, even deals that are coming from major labels that are looking a lot more fair and looking more like partnerships that are more 50-50 deals, that are more licensing deals instead of in perpetuity master ownership. But it comes down to both. You know, if artists are willing to accept shitty deals, they're going to keep feeding us shitty deals. You know, it doesn't matter how good of a job a lawyer does if the artist at the end of the day says the money's too good, the opportunity's too good, I still want to do it. I hear what you're saying, but I want that deal. So it comes down to both artists standing up for themselves, educating themselves, empowering themselves, knowing what they can ask for. But also on the other side, it requires the business, the label, to start changing the way that they are doing business and pushing it more towards a more equitable partnership than just I own what you create.
Agreed. Agreed. Okay. That's a beautiful place to end it. Ryan, I appreciate your time, man. It's been so dope having you on. We're definitely, everybody, y'all know, y'all could look on the screen if you're watching on YouTube on how to follow him. It'll be on the description. Spotify, it'll be in the details. But this is yet another episode of No Labels Necessary. I'm Brad Van Sean.
And I'm Corey.
Yeah, and we out.
Peace.
Appreciate you for watching. If you like content like this, you'll love seeing our music marketing strategies that we use as an agency to actually blow up artists to millions and even billions of streams that are available for free at nolabelsnecessary.com. And the cool part about it that's going to really make you love it is we don't have to be all entertaining and add all this fluff just to get some views that we do on YouTube. We get straight to the information. There's play-by-play and courses that give you a breakdown of every step that you should do to get success. And you have the ability to have communication with us. We get on live talks, a lot of cool things for members, and it's free just to hop in. So check it out right now at nolabelsnecessary.com.